Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, editor Andrew Blauner chats with acclaimed writers A.O. Scott and Rafia Zakaria about their contributions to the essay anthology Now Comes Good Sailing, Writers Reflect on Henry David Thoreau. This conversation originally took place October 21st, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
My name is Sonal Shukla, and I'm the Assistant Director of Programs and Education at the American Writers Museum. We're here tonight to talk about A Prophet of Environmentalism and Vegetarianism, an abolitionist and a critic of materialism and technology. Henry David Thoreau is the subject of essays from 27 of America's leading contemporary writers in Now Comes Good Sailing, a new collection from Princeton University Press. Joining us this evening to talk about the book are Andrew Blauner, anthologist and founder of Blauner Books Literacy Agency, Rafia Zakaria, columnist and author of The Upstairs Wife, An Intimate History of Pakistan, and New York Times film critic and distinguished professor of film criticism at Wesleyan University, A.O. Scott. Welcome, you all.
Thank you to everyone at the museum. Thank you to Princeton University Press for publishing this book, to all of the contributors, in particular, Rafia and Tony, for giving up your time tonight, and to everyone out there who's given up part of your night to spend a little bit of it with us. I do want to mention I have been to the museum. I'm in New York City at the moment, about as far away in some ways as you could be from a Thoreauvian cabin. But I have been to Chicago to the museum there, and I want to recommend everyone not just going there if you happen to be in the neighborhood, but make a point, make it your business to get there and build a trip around it. It's worth it. I was there once supporting the last anthology, which was about peanuts. And the museum kindly said, when you do the next one, please come back and do another event. And I do remember thinking that's very generous, but I don't think there's going to be a next one. You know, as our contributors maybe can relate, and a lot of writers out there, it's, you know, sometimes it's just such a heavy lift. And you just think, I'm not going to get the inspiration or the impetus to do another one. And what could be as American as peanuts that the American Museum of Writers would be interested in? Well, along comes Henry David Thoreau, who's been with us all this time, and along came COVID. And I mention that only because it was 18 months ago, it was April of last year, when this idea for the idea for this book didn't come to me. It had been festering. Wherever ideas that you're procrastinating over live, that's where it was for me. And I just had harbored hopes of getting this book into the world, but I just couldn't do it. I wouldn't do it until the pandemic hit. And that was, there's a writer in Boston named Pagan Kennedy who said at the time, we're all Thoreau now. And there was something about that sort of gave me that, just that push to try to at least make this book a reality. I think the working subtitle at some point was something to do with the timely and timeless Henry David Thoreau. It begs a question in a way of, are we in a Thoreauvian moment now because of the pandemic, or has it just been one 175-year moment that's never left us? For the most part, I just want to sort of lay the groundwork here and give you a little backstory, and then, as I say, sort of moderate this discussion about as much as I had to edit this book, which is to say not very much when you have writers of the caliber of Rafia and Tony and the 24 other essays. And there is a cartoon by Sandra Boynton in the book as well. The title, Now Comes Good Sailing, as some of you out there may know, was the last full sentence that Thoreau was known to have spoken. I should say just the last sentence. He went on to say two other words, reportedly moose and Indian, but Now Comes Good Sailing was the last sentence he spoke before he died. And I just knew at the outset, as those of you who've been involved with books, titles change all the time, and what you initially put as the placeholder almost never stays there all the while. In this case, it did. And when you put together this kind of collection, you know, one of the joys or rewards for me is putting together, literally putting it together and finding the kind of tapestry of writers and telling a story that most people know or think they know and telling it in a new way, in a kind of kaleidoscopic prism, different voices, different viewpoints. In this case, there was an easy hurdle to identify, which is the fallacy that when you talk about Thoreau, you just only talk about Walden, Walden Pond. And the reality is that the time he spent at Walden was 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days out of a life of about 44 years. So one of the contributors is Robert Sullivan, who wrote a terrific book of his own called The Thoreau You Don't Know. There was a lot of life beyond the pond at Walden. And part of my aspiration here was to tell some of that story and to do that. The vehicle of doing that was enlisting writers who would have fresh perspectives on that. I can't take any credit for pairing these two writers tonight, but I think it's a stroke of genius in a way, because it's such, the more I've thought about it, we just learned before we came on camera here that I think the three of us all have dogs, but other than that, and Thoreau, I'm not sure what else would unite us as a great democratizer, but I'm grateful, very grateful for the two of you individually, and it's really a fascinating combination, as I hope will manifest now. So with that, I'm going to kind of step aside, and at least for the time being, and turn it over first to Rafia, if I may, whose piece I just wanted to mention was excerpted in on Slate yesterday. So you can find her piece, I believe, in its unedited entirety, more or less, on Slate. And I also wanted to mention that I hadn't remembered for a while, the reason I think we got in touch, or I thought of Rafia, is she wrote a piece, I believe it was in Lit Hub in 2016, and the headline of which was A Feminist Thoreau, or as a lot of people pronounce Thoreau, as was thought to be perhaps the proper pronunciation. And it was about a woman, and Rafia, forgive me if I'm butchering the pronunciation, is it Anne Labastille?
Anne Labastille, yeah. Labastille.
So, Rafia, I'll have some maybe follow-up questions just to drop in here or there, but otherwise I'd love to just turn it over to you now for you to do with some block of time, whatever you see fit, with my thanks.
Thank you so much. And yes, that is precisely the essay that kind of began this journey for me. I am originally from Pakistan, from Karachi, and I very, very much come from an environment where being alone is, or, you know, going off by yourself, et cetera. Like, it's considered either, like, in an ordinary person, it's considered sad because it's like, why would you do that? It's a very, you know, collective communal culture. And on the other extreme, of course, like, is, you know, Sufi meditation and people who go away for the purpose of, like, intentional purpose of meditating. And my essay talks about both of those iterations, but it's, you know, because of my particular background, I've always been fascinated by women going off alone to live in the woods and developing a kind of self-sufficiency in themselves. You know, that is in a way how I actually ended up visiting the Thoreau Farm, is the Adirondack Writers Center in Saranac Lake up in upstate New York. In the Adirondacks has a residency named after Anne Labastille, which, you know, every October, they might actually, these might be the weeks actually in which, you know, they're there, but they have this gorgeous lodge on the lake where Anne Labastille lived. You can only get there by, like, you know, gravel road, and it's there's no cellular phone, there's nothing. And anyway, so I was there staying in this lodge and reading about Anne Labastille and visiting her little, very Thoreau-esque cabin that she had. And I was reading this book about the Transcendentalists, and that's kind of what led me to explore and go up and actually want to see, you know, what this was, what this place was all about, what Thoreau's, you know, context was, and, you know, just kind of to inhabit in his world, and also to make it relevant for me as a woman of color. You know, I always feel, I'm trying to get over it, but I've, you know, in discussions about the environment and about sort of natural life and surroundings, I always feel a bit awkward. And I tried to convey that in my piece because there's something for an immigrant, there's always something slightly disconcerting because their inner expectation of what nature around them should be is different from what actually is. So even now, after like decades of being here in the US, I will sometimes look outside and be like, where am I? Like, where am I? Where are the crows and the palm trees and, you know, the loud, awful traffic? And so, you know, so a lot of noise and a lot of people were definitely my comfort zone. And, you know, and it took me a while to develop kind of the strength to go to a cabin and stay there by myself and write. And I did it, but I don't think that there is any other experience that can teach you about what that is like, except actually doing that. You know, it also exposed to me all the fears I had, right? So if I were, you know, wanting, you know, like Thoreau, to go live in that, in a cabin that's slightly away, well, I would be a woman, I would be by myself. You know, how safe would that be? Could I do it? It's interesting how those questions come up almost immediately for women when they are considering this question of solitude that, you know, men don't really think about. They just don't. And so I wanted to take time to think through that. I wanted to take time to understand what that means. And, you know, and then it was while I was in staying in the Adirondacks that I went to see, you know, what I talk about in my essay, The Philosopher's Camp, which is when Emerson, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson took all these philosophers and botanists and poets off to these woods that, you know, that are up there near Saranac. And he took them there and he basically, they were going to camp and like have these sort of lofty philosophical discussions and, you know, find bugs and like do stuff like that, I guess, have a campfire. And I was just, you know, I wished I could have been there. But, you know, Louisa May Alcott, who wrote Little Women, was living not far at that time. And her father was allowed to go to this camp. But of course, she couldn't go because she was a woman. And that's what got me interested in trying to consider what it would have been like to apprehend or to see the Transcendentalists, like if I ran into them taking a walk in the woods and saw all these people, but I wasn't sort of, you know, considered, intelligent and philosophical enough to belong to that group. So so those are some of the thoughts that I had, in going through that. Finally, you know, the philosophical impact of Thoreau on my own writing has been very significant. I just finished a book called, I just released a book called Against White Feminism. And one of the central precepts in that book is that feminists, if they are going to be a radical force, can never align with the state, which is, you know, Thoreau's point in civil disobedience. So it has had, considering philosophical self-sufficiency, it has been an integral part of my own development as a theorist and as a feminist theorist. So I will stop there.
Yeah, thank you, Rafia. It's actually a terrific place to stop, if only because I was going to let this sort of play out organically, but you led me right up to what I was going to hope to use as sort of the connective tissue between you, other than dogs and Thoreau, which is camp. And you write about it and talk about philosopher's camp, just what that conjures is kind of interesting and comical. And I just want to read from Tony, part of the Tony's bio that was not read aloud, but that is in the book, reads, "As a child, he spent several summers at Camp Thoreau, where he learned to live deliberately and excelled at capture the flag." Didn't just participate, but excelled. So the estimable A.O. Scott, do with your time again, however you see fit, and I'll be following up with both of you. But if you want to talk about this camp experience, please do.
I would be happy to. The camp sadly no longer exists, and I will note that the best known former attendee of Camp Thoreau. I didn't go there at the same time because I'm older than he is. Is Ben Affleck?
Who
the one time I met him, we discovered that we'd gone to the same summer camp. I wish you'd known that, Andrew. You could have had him contribute. That's interesting. I mean, the camp.
He could star in the movie.
That's it. He could play Henry. Yeah. Or maybe, you know, it'll be Matt Damon as Henry.
Be Emerson.
Yeah, he's the friend, you know, the like in Good Will Hunting. Anyway, the camp was a kind of a descendant of the old line, mostly Jewish left wing summer camps of the 30s and 40s. Which were a very important part of kind of left-wing Jewish immigrants' journey into America, and my mother had gone to several such camps, one called Woodland, one called Kinderland, and Camp Thoreau was started in the mid '60s by the kind of the next generation, and it was very much about living close to nature, close to the land, being non-hierarchical, instilling in kids a certain amount of social and political consciousness, living very simply. You know, there were it was long before cell phones or anything like that, but there was no electronic equipment, and it was a lovely, it was a wonderful and very intense and very formative experience for me. And I made a lot of good friendships there and learned a lot there. But I never, you know, I never connected it really. It wasn't like there was any study of Thoreau. I mean, his name was there. It was in the lower Catskills in upstate New York, and then since it was a kind of a left-wing institution, there was a schism, and it split in two, and that camp stayed there, and another faction went up to Vermont, to near White River Junction, which is where I went. I was part of that faction. But it was certainly, you know, there a very kind of communitarian and socially aware version of Thoreau, not so much the sort of the solitary anarchist version, but the abolitionist, the the ecologist, the anti-imperialist, all of those things that Thoreau was. And you know, I think I probably absorbed some of those lessons without necessarily knowing that they had much to do with him. And it wasn't until I was in college and then in graduate school that I really discovered him as a writer and as a thinker, and as a thinker whose ideas and strategies of writing and representation were much more complicated than the sort of the simplified version maybe that the summer camp had instilled in us. And I found him a very complicated and very difficult and very strange in a wonderful way kind of writer, in a way that so many of the writers of the middle of the 19th century, who we now think of as the great geniuses of that moment, who were not necessarily recognized as such at the time, Melville, Dickinson, Whitman, Thoreau, really were very strange writers, very, very radical, very, very extreme sometimes. It's very hard to map them onto any genre or into any tradition. It's very hard. Many philosophers, I think, most notably Stanley Cavell, maybe have tried to put Thoreau into some kind of tradition to say, well, he belongs to pragmatism, or he belongs to romanticism, or he belongs to anarchy, or he belongs to libertarianism, but he doesn't. He belongs to Thoreau. He belongs to New England and his own very, very idiosyncratic and wonderful mind. So anyway, I was very happy and also surprised when Andrew asked me to contribute to this volume, since, of course, he didn't know any of this about me. But I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. You know, I thought, well, I don't know. I mean, I sort of realized I had many thoughts about Thoreau over the years and many ways that I could have gone in trying to write about him. But shortly after I agreed to do it, like many people during the pandemic, I fled into the woods to a place that I have a cabin, a literal cabin, on an island in Maine, where there are quite a lot of apple trees. And I've been, over the last few years since I and my wife and some friends of ours got this place, I've been obsessed with the apple trees there because they're very strange. There are fruit unlike anything I've ever seen, you know, in the farmer's market. Tiny little yellow ones with sort of ridges around the sides, big soft green ones. And I had been kind of reading up on apples and curious about apples. And I read Michael Pollan's The Botany of Desire, which has a wonderful chapter about Johnny Appleseed and the sort of the appling of North America, of the Eastern United States, and how a little before Thoreau was around, Johnny Appleseed, you know, was a very Thoreauvian character who just wandered around disseminating apples, bringing canoes full of seeds, and either giving them to farmers to start orchards or scattering them far and wide. And the interesting thing about apples is they're usually grown and cultivated by grafting, so that's how you control what kind of apple you get. Because a wild apple, every apple seed may produce an entirely new variety of apple. The genome in there is so complicated that you don't know what, if you plant a seed and grow an apple from there, you don't know what. It could come out of a Granny Smith and you could get some completely different thing. So Thoreau wrote this essay, one of the last things of his that was published, which was based on a lecture that he'd given many times before, called Wild Apples, which is a really extraordinary text that I had read before and forgotten about. And I was there in the middle of the apple trees, which were under attack from these horrible moth caterpillars that eat all the leaves and completely defoliate the trees. And I thought, I need to do something with these with these apples, and maybe Thoreau will help me understand what I'm doing amid these apples. And I found a really remarkable text. It's not very well known. It isn't the best way you can find it is on the website of the Atlantic Magazine, which is where it was published in 1862. It's not in most of the most popular anthologies of his short works, including it's not even in the Library of America editions. And it's an absolutely wonderful, strange, poetic, weirdly erotic text about apples and how beautiful they are and how they cater to a human appetite for beauty. And he riffs on the Garden of Eden, and he makes up all kinds of fanciful names for apples. And it's kind of pretending to be a lecture on natural science, which is probably how he presented it, you know, on the lecture circuit in New England in the 1850s. But it's much stranger and more wonderful than that. So I was just very interested. It got me thinking about Thoreau as a writer. I wouldn't say a philosopher, but as a thinker who is very concerned with beauty and with aesthetics and with the centrality of aesthetics and pleasure and beauty in our lives with each other and also in our lives in nature. And I kept reading and read other late essays, The Succession of Forest Trees and Autumnal Tints, which kind of pick up this idea. And so I just sort of riffed on that, pretending that I was kind of sitting in my accidental orchard, you know, among the wild apples, in a sort of Thoreauvian frame of mind, trying to learn from him in a way to appreciate and understand what I was seeing and smelling and tasting.
Thanks, Tony. I have a lot of follow-ups for you and for Rafia as well. I'm going to go back to Rafia first, and I'm going to quote you to yourself a little bit and maybe ask you to pick up whichever of these sort of you feel compelled to sort of discuss or unpack or whatever you think. You mentioned, well, the title of your piece is The Fragility of Solitude. And solitude, just incidentally, is a theme of one of the other early anthologies that I thought about trying to put together, because there have been some, Anthony Storr wrote a phenomenal book called Solitude. There's some great, great writing about that subject. But Rafia, you refer to solitude as, quote unquote, an ingredient of fantasy. And it sort of immediately reminded me of George Plimpton once wrote about playing right field in baseball. And because there's so little that happens, generally speaking, of all the positions, that it's sort of a place where great ideas come from, because there's plenty of time when there's no action in right field in baseball. So you have a lot of reveries and a lot of invention, or to use your word, perhaps fantasy. I mean, maybe I'll stop there. Is there anything about that sort of solitude as an ingredient of fantasy that provokes you to say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that again goes to a dimension of it that I think is more that women would think about more than I would say men, and that is that you know, Thoreau sought kind of he was advocating and did himself a physical separation from society or Concord and everything that was in Concord. And you know, one of the reasons why I call it a fantasy is that I don't think there's a reckoning there. Not that, you know, I'm not criticizing him, but I don't think there was a reckoning there of the emotional labor that women have to do. And that constantly kind of encroaches on your solitude. You know, I think that even if we're physically separated, even now, especially, you know, women more by and large are saddled with maintaining the emotional tone and tenor of a household or a family, any group that they're in. And, you know, one of the struggles, therefore, for women in pursuing solitude, particularly, I would say, you know, in my case as a writer, you need solitude. But one of the things that you really, I have struggled with is that I don't want to sort of abandon my responsibilities in terms of like being there for people when I write, because that also makes me feel, you know, frustrated. So, you know, so that kind of act is fantastic in that sense, because it's so hard for women. I mean, I've been to residencies and talked about this at length with a lot of women, female creatives, and they all struggle with this idea of how indulgent it is to choose solitude and your peace of mind, and, you know, to kind of cultivate boundaries that would allow you to do that without feeling that there were a whole lot of sort of consequences that were waiting for you the second you came back from this cabin. And I think that that's something that environmentalists and naturalists, I mean, you know, as Scott said, there are kind of abstract ideas, and then there is the effort to sort of live them, right? And in that sense, to translate a Thoreauvian search for solitude into the actual lives of women requires considering these questions. It requires considering, for instance, that to women it feels like a fantasy because they are, you know, there's all these gendered expectations of, you know, like, and that's why I write about the women in Thoreau's life. You know, I mean, someone was making those baked goods and bringing those to him, and you know, someone was doing, a woman was doing his laundry, and so on. And also emotionally probably managing him. I mean, he could go down on Sunday to see his mom, and she could, like, you know, be, hey, I mean, you know, provide him with all the emotional support that, you know, he might have needed for him to be in solitude the rest of the time. And, you know, responsibilities that we all have impede on our solitude. And the more responsibilities you have, the more fantastic the idea of solitude becomes.
I mean, that's so provocative and resonant. And it's almost hard to be honest with ourselves, I think, in a way. I mean, I think it's a fact that there is still this, if it's not a pathologizing, there's a stigma that is applied to a woman who seeks solitude versus a man. We might be in denial about it, but it's just palpable that it's still there, which is kind of remarkable given where we are otherwise and where we've come from, or it's not remarkable and it's just sad and just shows how much further we have to go. I mean, I will say too, that in trying to find a home for this project, you know, there were more than a couple of publishers who said, oh, I love Thoreau and, you know, it's worth telling the story in this such and such a way, but it's really only for older white men. You don't check any of those boxes.
No, I don't.
You're one of a kind, but I think you speak on behalf of I hope, a growing population of people.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was talking about just this to a number of Pakistani feminists, and they were in Pakistan, and they were discussing how you know, these are women who decided not to marry and who, you know, sort of want to preserve their solitude. And it's interesting to hear from them, first of all, how much, like, once you have experienced it, and if you have done the work that's required for solitude to exist, right? So all the kind of inner work that you have to do, that, you know, it's one of the things that's taught them that, you know, like the life of, you know, being part of this big family and having children, creating a family of their own, etc., is not the life for everyone. And There's another real quick point that I wanted to bring up just because I want to hear what you guys think about it. You know, there's a lot said about how Thoreau was living at the cusp of great change, right? Because the railroad was coming in, the telegraph, et cetera, et cetera. And he criticized both. I think he with the telegram, he said something like, "Oh, the most amazing news we'll learn is that Princess Adelaide has got the whooping cough." And I don't know who Princess Adelaide was, but obviously he didn't see much in that. And I feel that there is a particular resonance of our current moment, you know, with that time, because we are also living at a very transformative movement in an odd sort of way. I mean, you know, with the railways, human beings were discussing like how to get themselves from, you know, travel these long distances. And now we're figuring out, you know, how to send information and images. And instead of us moving at all, we can, you know, do this. And I don't know what the sort of end point of this will be. And so I share his skepticism about some of the new forms of existing. And I especially share his, you know, just sense of not being entirely sure where the world was headed, and taking solace in the natural world for that reason.
Thank you for that. And for whatever reason, that compels me just to mention someone else's book, Sue Halpern, is a long time ago, 20 years ago, maybe, called Migrations to Solitude, which was, as I recall, sort of case studies of maybe 3-4 people who renounced society as we know it. It'd be interesting, at least to me, to go back and see how it broke down in terms of gender. I remember loving the book and going to try to find it years later, and it was out of print, and I thought, this is a travesty. And so fortunately that's available again. Tony, I'm remembering now, as far as what was the catalyst for, I mean, aside from the fact that you're a Renaissance man and, you know, not just about movies, but about books and about a great many things. But I think that the reason, more specifically, although it's a bit of a indirect reach, that I reached out to you for this was part of the series that you're writing for the Times Book Review. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the series. The Americans. And you wrote a phenomenal cover story about Wallace Stegner. And in it, you mentioned arguably my favorite novel of the last 50 years, which was The Spectator Bird, which is the story. It's coincidental that the protagonist is a literary agent, but the story and what's strange among so many things is that it won the National Book Award. And some of the most well-read people I know, far better read than I am, have not only not read the book, have not even heard of it. But in essence, it's a story of a man who's looking back at his life and wondering if he had been too much of a spectator. And I think that somewhere in all what you're writing about that, I thought of Thoreau's not wanting to get to the end of life and thinking I hadn't lived. And there was just some resonance there. So, and you know, the camp, just to be clear to everyone else, there's nothing in the piece about the camp. Especially not about Capture the Flag, which I want to get into at some other time. But Tony, or just your line, I came into possession of about a dozen apple trees. That was arresting in itself. And then you say the trees really took possession of me. But, you know, can you just sort of pick this up? And you talk about Thoreau being, if I have the phrase written down correctly, defiantly impractical. You raise the question of what was Thoreau for, F-O-R, what did he love? I mean, did any of this want to spark something more you want to run with?
Yeah, I mean, part of it, it's funny, you know, often there's an invisible or unacknowledged argument in your head that you're having when you're writing something. And this piece was partly that. There was an article published, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, maybe more, in the New Yorker by Catherine Schultz, a writer who I'm friendly with and admire very, very much. That was the sort of the takedown of Henry Thoreau, of sort of about how he was, you know, he was a hypocrite. He was a scold. He was judgmental. He was kind of all wrong and not worthy of our admiration. And it was a very well argued and I thought very passionate and completely wrong piece. But the wonderful thing, it can be a gift when a very talented and persuasive writer writes something that you completely disagree, you know, that you just feel kind of almost metaphysically antagonistic to, because you have to figure out what you would say. And so in a way, it was my argument in my head with Catherine, when I was trying to figure out what is it, what's the case for Thoreau, what even, you know, stipulating all of the worst kind of sarcastic, eye-rolling, impatient responses to Thoreau that many, many people have had over the years, probably including a great many American high school students who have had, you know, had to read Walden in the most unimaginative, least solitary circumstances in the classroom. What would be the case you would make? And it struck me, because I sort of was reading some of the criticism of Thoreau that had been written, and there is a lot about what he opposed. There is a lot about whether it's his opposition to slavery, American imperialism, the railroad, the telegraph, agriculture, industry, the state. You know, you can sort of go down the list, and you think he's a sort of a purely negative thinker and writer, which he's not. If you really read him, you know that there's enormous abundance and playfulness and ardor and curiosity and passion in all of his writing, in the political writing as well as in the travel writing and the nature writing and in the notebooks, you know. And so I was just trying to kind of answer that question for myself: what kind of thinker, what kind of writer is he? What is the sort of the positive charge that he gives that keep people coming back to him? And I kind of found some idea of an answer in some of these late essays, because I wanted to sort of stay away from the most canonical work, because I figured that a lot of people would cover it much better and more imaginatively than I could. But I think that I sort of came up with two things or two sides of a single idea, one of which is, as I said before, his interest in beauty, his real commitment to aesthetic experience as a primary form of human experience. That is this idea, you know, we always think of politics, good, you know, morality, ethics, all of these things are much more important in our minds than art, beauty, cultivation, pleasure. That's always a sort of a secondary category of experience. And the question for a lot of writers, and I think including for Thoreau, is what does it look like? What's the case for that? What's the defense of our interest in beauty and pleasure? And what do we find in nature that satisfies our appetite for beauty, which is a thread through Week in the Concord and Merrimack, through the Maine Woods, through Cape Cod. He's finding and delivering to his readers beautiful things and beautiful experiences and kind of experiences of the sublime and the unexpected. And he's trying to categorize them and describe them and communicate them to you. And that's the other thing, is that he is, to me, one of the most companionate and companionable writers. And there is never solitude in Thoreau, because you're always, when he's writing, because the act of writing, even when you're writing in your journal to yourself, is a social act. I was working on something else recently, and I came across a quote attributed, or an idea attributed to Marx, that the irreducible human unit is not the individual, it's not one, but two. Whether it's, you know, parent and child, couple, friends, boss and worker, there's never just one. And I think Thoreau's paradigm of that is in his writing, that there's the writer and the reader. There's a companionship, there's a communication, there's something that is both very much a form of solitude and also the negation of solitude.
I mean, it strikes me, you just, with that last point, you led me to realize we've gone 45 minutes now, haven't mentioned, just because you mentioned A Week on the Concord, it's the first mention of that. We haven't even mentioned Civil Disobedience, I don't think. We haven't mentioned his brother, John, who was arguably the most profound influence on his life. We haven't mentioned his romantic sexual life. He and his brother both proposed to the same woman. Jennifer Finney Boylan has a piece in the book. James Marcus writes also about that aspect of his life. George Howe Colt writes about Thoreau's love of ice skating. Who knew, right? There's so much here, but like you put your finger on something that's so elemental, I guess, and that strikes a chord. It did for me. And, you know, having nothing to do with apples and wild, I didn't know the difference between wild apples and apples really before I read your piece.
Well, this was a lovely discussion. I would like to thank you all for a wonderful evening, and to all our audience, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, we chat with Sigrid Nunez about her recent book, What Are You Going Through? Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.